Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 2nd, 2006. Our session today is entitled, I Was a Teenage Cataphatic, an Ecumenical Consensus Seven Times. Our presenter is Paul Bosch, session number BOP 2006-05. Let's listen in.
534, let's sing that version of it.
Now thank we all our God with hearts and hands and voices, who wondrous things has done, in whom his word rejoices, who from our mother's arms has blessed us on our way with countless gifts of love, and still is ours today.
Third,
all praise and thanks to God, the Father thou be given, the Son and him who reigns with them in highest heaven, the one eternal God, who
get any better than that, huh? I mean, guide me, O thou great Jehovah, is pretty good, and love divine, all loves excelling, is pretty good, and oh God, our help in ages past is pretty good. But that's, in my view, that's the greatest hymn ever written. Okay, friends, you are meeting with Paul Bosch here tonight, and you're learning how I was a teenage cataphatic. Now you're asking, what's cataphatic? We'll get to that in a minute. Let me tell you that I have here a draft copy of the new worship hymnal for Lutherans. It's not going to be as fat as this. This is cheap paper, but it's going to be printed on nice paper. It'll be thinner than this book. I have the copy of the book here, and I have the indexes here. Further, in the bookstore, you can find these two volumes, which I asked them to have ready for us for these sessions. First, Creating Common Worship and Uncommon Worship, and second, Re-Pitching the Tent. This was the first book Richard Giles wrote. This is the second book he wrote. This one has to do with architecture and how he took an old Victorian pile of stones in Philadelphia, tore everything out on the inside, and made it into a magnificent worship space for the 21st century. Then this tells how they do worship in that space. It's Anglican, Episcopal. But they're both very, very good, very, very radically egalitarian worship. By egalitarian, I mean almost no sense of hierarchy. Okay. Let me begin with a couple of things before we get to cataphatic. Let me tell you what keeps me going, among other things. When life looks grim and bad and terrible, this is what keeps me going. I heard a lecture by a Roman Catholic. She was a woman theologian, Roman Catholic. This was 15 years ago, who laid out a system that she said pertains whenever there is a major breakthrough in human history. She's talking of, I'm not sure whether this was her own idea or whether she was quoting somebody else, but in any case, Pat Mischke is her name. Have you ever heard that name before? Anyhow, Pat Mischke says, gotta get my ears adjusted here, I got very bad hearing. Pat Mischke says that whenever there's a major breakthrough in human history, it is always preceded by two other periods. First, we'll call this period A, There's a period of experimentation and inventing new stuff and new models, new paradigms. My goodness, a period of, kind of preview of coming attractions. This is how the world could be. And that can last some months or even some years. That's period A. Period B follows, and as you might guess, it is a period of reaction. Repression, regression. Oh, all that stuff in period A was too scary. All that stuff in period A was much too exotic and much too dangerous. We have to put the lid on. We have to screw down things tight. We have to go back to the previous verities, that kind of thing. And this period B of repression and regression and reaction, that can last some months or some years. Then, when that's out of our system, as human beings, then period C breaks through, and that looks like period A. That's the new age in its fullness. Now, I'm here to tell you that I am a child of the 60s. I was already ordained for 5 years before 1960. I was ordained 50 years ago this year, had a big celebration. I was ordained 50 years ago, but in 1960, I came to the campus. I've been campus pastor, university chaplain, most of my life. And in 1960, I came to Syracuse University as chaplain for the first time in campus ministry. Before that, I was in a parish. Now I was on the campus. And I love the 60s. I'm not saying I would endorse everything that happened in the 60s. I mean, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I'm not sure about all that stuff. But just think of what happened in the 60s. The civil rights movement, the peace movement, Vietnam War and all that stuff, the ecology movement, the women's movement, gay liberation, and Second Vatican Council that turned Roman Catholic Church inside out. I mean, all the things that Martin Luther and John Calvin and those guys were after in the 16th century, Rome did in the Second Vatican Council. Translated the Mass into the language of the people, pulled the altar out from the wall so that the priest could stand behind it like the head of the family gathered around the table. Wonderful stuff happening in the Roman Catholic Church in the 1960s. Now, dear friends, we are in period B, beginning with Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II, I'm sorry to say, as winsome as he was and as charismatic as he was very reactionary and very repressive and regressive. And it looks even worse under the present Pope. In any case, we are living, I would regard, in period B. But when the kingdom of God comes in its fullness, as I have said, pontificating on other occasions, pontificate? Anyhow, I have said that when the kingdom of God comes in its fullness, it's going to look like the 60s. I mean, only partly joking about that. There were some wonderful things that happened in the 60s, and I would love to see them come to fruit. And let me say this, I do not see anything in period B that is going to prevent period A from breaking through as period C. Period C is on the way, no matter what. Right now, the Pope wants to keep the women back in the kitchen and the gays back in the closet, and that can't last. Period B is going to give way one of these days to period C. And it's going to look like period A. Okay, let me tell you four things that our Lutheran World Federation discovered in a study on worship. This was, 10 years ago? Maybe not even that. There was a worldwide study among Lutheran churches by the Lutheran World Federation, and they came up with these four realities. They said, they maintain that our worship, in order to be faithful, ought to be enculturated. It ought to be in the language of the people, in thought forms and in architectural forms and so on that are contemporary and that the people today can understand. These and thous and beseeches and vouchsafes and all that kind of stuff from Tudor language, Shakespearean language, is very lovely. I love the King James Bible, but it makes less and less sense to people today. So we have to enculturate our worship. That's first. But in the second place, our worship ought to be also countercultural. We don't want to baptize everything that's out there. There's a lot of unwholesome stuff out there in the culture, and our worship ought to be a critic of that. We should not simply assume that everything in our world, in our culture, is hunky-dory. We ought to be willing to give it a good criticism, countercultural worship. In the third instance, transcultural. And transcultural means going all the way back in the centuries, honoring the tradition. Can you think of transcultural words, for instance, that we use in our liturgy today? Language. How about amen? You know, that's a Hebrew word, and it means?
So be it.
Very good. It shall be so. So be it. That goes for me. Amen. When you pray a prayer, and I pray amen to it, I am endorsing your words. And that's a Hebrew idea, and it's Hebrew language. That's transcultural. A couple more transcultural words. Alleluia.
Alleluia.
That's a Hebrew word. It means praise to the Lord. Anyhow, that kind of stuff is transcultural. I would argue also that bread and wine at the communion is transcultural, not grape juice. Grape juice was invented 100 years ago. Never could have had it until they invented pasteurization. Should be wine. Alcoholic wine that has the potency to make you drunk. I mean, that's part of the whole point of it. That's what the Jews used. That's what Jesus used. That's what the church down through the ages until 1850 used. In 1850, they invented pasteurization, and along came the temperance movement, and I'm not defending alcoholism. That's a terrible thing. But still, it ought to be wine. And if you can't take the wine, just take the bread. You're still getting the full Jesus. That's called concomitance, the doctrine of concomitance. The total Christ is present in either the bread or the wine. If for reasons you can't eat the bread, just take the cup. But don't have grape juice. Sorry, Holden Village. Anyhow, moving along. Transcultural, cross-cultural. I said the other day that you are living in an age of unprecedented hymnody. I mean, you are living in the golden age of hymnody. Not since before the Reformation have there been such wonderful choices of hymns. And they're cross-cultural. Hispanic, African-American, African, Asian hymns. And our new book, I should point out, has a great big section of them. Cross-cultural hymns. As a matter of fact, there are going to be 10. 10 versions of Holy Communion in here. One of which is African-American. The other of which is Hispanic. So, enculturated, countercultural, transcultural, and cross-cultural. Okay, now let's get to cataphatic. Urban Holmes, you should know that name. writes a book called, help me out, Elaine, is it called History of Christian Spirituality or something like that? Anyhow, he has a very useful diagram that I would like to lay upon you. As a matter of fact, if we had the space for it, I'd draw the diagram on the floor and have you actually sculpture it, but I won't do it. Urban Holmes says that all of religious experience, I think he would be that bold, all of religious experience can be graphed on this kind of a grid. This is the first set of polarities, and at this end of things is the mind. He calls this speculative, but it doesn't mean guesswork. It means having to do with the brain, the head, thought, ideas. At this end is heart. He calls that the emotive. There are some spiritualities that appeal to the mind, the brain, the rational left side of the brain. There are other spiritualities that appeal to the heart, the emotions. Okay, that's one set of polarities. Now, there's an east-west polarity too. Over here he puts our famous word here, cataphatic. And that means sympathetic to forms. It actually means with or pertaining to words, language. So, for instance, this kind of spirituality is comfortable with creeds, with liturgies that are written out, with ceremonies like candles and certain ways of gesturing and so on. That's all cataphatic spirituality. At this end of the pole, you have apophatic. And apophatic, as you might guess, is the opposite of cataphatic. It's suspicious of forms. It's suspicious of ceremonies. It's suspicious of liturgies and creeds and doctrines and stuff like that. Okay, now you could put, you know, you could probably put yourself on that grid. I certainly could. I was raised about here. My dad was a Lutheran pastor. He was a German pietist. And he was smart. He was intelligent. He was learned. He knew Greek. He knew Latin. He knew German. He knew English. Whenever he taught us a new word when we were kids, he says, now, this comes from the Greek root that means such and such. I mean, that's the kind of father he was. But he also wanted to instruct my heart. And he taught me hymns. And he taught me to love the liturgy and the hymn book. That's all pretty cataphatic, isn't it? Now, what would you put up here? Maybe rationalists, huh? People that are a little more top of the head. What would you put down here? How about Mennonites, Quakers, right? They want to instruct the heart, but they're a little suspicious of forms. You know, their service is very austere, very simple. Am I right?
Yeah.
Okay. And up here, you may have the social gospel people, the people who want to get out there and change the world. Or you might have the desert fathers, you know, or the desert mothers. There were desert mothers too, apparently. People who lived in monastic communities or sometimes even as hermits out in the, you know, wilderness and tried to cultivate a spirituality that was very much rational but also a little removed from corporate worship and hymns and liturgies and that kind of stuff. So, where would you put yourself on that? I sometimes have done this with classes that I teach, and I take a masking tape, and I put it on the floor, and I have you stand where you were raised. Where were you brought up? In which quadrant? Then I ask, What quadrant is attractive to you now? Where do you hear the Spirit calling you? I must say, this stuff was very bizarre to me a couple of years ago even. But now it's making more and more sense. Henry Nouwen, do you know that name? I think I've been through Henry Nouwen's book, Bread for the Journey. They have Bread for the Journey at the bookstore. And I get to the end of the year. It's a little paragraph for every day of the year. And I get to the end of the book, and I start right over again at the beginning. And I think I've done that 6 times. And I also have that book that I quoted this morning that I use for my worship. But I do love hymns, and I do love, you know, Greek Orthodox. Where would Greek Orthodox be? Wow, way over here. You know, I mean, they love to say, Lord have mercy, 90 times. That's a little much for me. But I mean, that's the very cataphatic type of spirituality. And it could be very attractive, too. Again, it's a matter of getting used to what you're used to. People say, I know what I like. They really should say, I like what I know. What are you comfortable with? What did you grow up with? That kind of thing. Now, for whatever it's worth, Urban Holmes thinks that if you get too far out from this center, you're probably in trouble, and you're probably getting into danger zones of one kind or another. And a fellow like Robert Jensen, do you know that name? Has he been at Holden Village? I'll bet he has. He's a Lutheran theologian. And he says, the Lutheran take on things, which is, I think, also the Catholic take on things, and the Episcopal take on things, and the United Church take on things, and the Presbyterian take on things, all of that is basically cataphatic. And if you get too apophatic, you're no longer incarnational. You're getting away from God coming in the flesh. See, that's part of our Christian message, isn't it? That God comes in the flesh, in that baby in the manger. Martin Luther used to love to point out how the manger was full of straw and maybe also cow manure, but it also held the baby who was the light of the world. And if we believe that Emmanuel, God with us, is part of the Christian message, then we don't dare get too far over here. I think Jensen has a point, in other words, that the Christian faith is basically incarnational and sacramental. Okay, having done all that as a prelude, let us turn now to the ecumenical consensus of our day. I should let you know, that you are living in an incredible time. Not since before the Reformation has there been an ecumenical consensus about what is important in the Christian faith as there is today. Have you heard of the document Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry? I think at one time, anyhow, the bookstore did have it. They were selling it. And it's a little slim thing. You can read it in an evening. But what it represents is the consensus view of theologians and teachers and pastors representing Lutheran, Roman Catholic, Anglican, Episcopal, Baptist, Presbyterian, United Church, all the way to Quakers and Pentecostals on the one end, and Orthodox, Greek Orthodox and Russian Orthodox on the other end. All of these theologians coming together in Lima, Peru, L-I-M-A, Lima, Peru. This is sometimes called the Lima document. They came up with a document called Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry. And that document spells out what all of these groups, if you can imagine them agreeing, but they did, what all of these groups hold to be true about baptism, Holy Communion, and ministry. So, for instance, it may shock you to learn that the consensus about baptism is that the Baptists were right all along, and we should be dunking. We should be immersing. Martin Luther thought it was the fuller side. It shows death and resurrection much better than a little couple of dabs of moisture on the head of a baby. Now, a couple of dabs of moisture on the head of a baby is probably sufficient to say we've seen a valid baptism. On the other hand, it doesn't have any of the picture of drowning and rising again that baptism by immersion does. So, all of our churches have some homework to do in that area, it seems to me. And if you are building a new church, as this guy did, out of an old church, you want to provide for the possibility of dunking. Can you see the picture on the cover? I'll pass this book around. He's taken the old font, which is a handsome old marble tub, and he's put a groove in the top of it so that the water overflows. It's bubbling. The water overflows into a great big tank, like a stock watering tank. I've been in that church, and it's quite a remarkable font. If you've been to St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Manhattan, New York City, they have a font like that, like a hot tub, practically. Okay. Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, this document of which I just spoke, lays out what I would regard as an ecumenical consensus that is altogether unprecedented since before the Reformation. Now, a lot of this stuff is being challenged today. It's not altogether unanimous. I think the present Pope has some misgivings about a lot of stuff that might be in that document. Again, you see, this is the document that comes out of that period A, and we're living in period B. So, and the megachurches, a lot of the megachurches don't pay any attention to what I'm laying out now in front of you. But this is the ecumenical consensus, wide agreement, not altogether unanimous, but wide agreement. And we're not talking here about what's right and what's wrong. We're trying to discern what is faithful and what shows the gospel most clearly. Again, what we're talking in all of these sessions, we're talking quality control. We're not in sales tonight. We're in quality control. And so you're hearing shop talk among church leaders. Okay, here's the first thing that might surprise you. This new consensus is indebted to anthropology and ritual studies more than anything else. It's not that they're going back in history and looking at the history of all these rites and ceremonies. It's not that they're interested in the arts for the sake of the arts, that is to say, what looks pretty or whatever. But they're going back to ritual studies, and we talked about that in my first session. Anthropology and ritual studies are telling them are giving them some clues. Victor Turner, Marcia Iliade, do you know some of those names? Anyhow, those are giants in this field, and they are telling us, look, all people everywhere have a religion, even if it's a religion of the golf course, and they will act out, they will find a way to ritualize that religion. And therefore, phenomenology, that's another fancy word you might hear, it's not from history, it's not from theology, it's not from aesthetics, the finer things in life. It's not from market research, trying to find out what the baby boomers want and give it to them. It is from anthropology and ritual studies. I should say, autobiographically, I found my vocation here 45 years ago, 5 years after I was ordained, when I read this book by J.A.T. Robinson, Liturgy Coming to Life. And he was coming out of this kind of consensus. And he pointed out to me that ritual and religion even does not have to be a dirty word. A couple of sessions ago, I contrasted the word ritual with the word routine. Ritual is something you do over and over again that you would miss if you did not do it. Routine is something that you do over and over again that you would not miss if you did not do it. Taking out the garbage. You have to take out the garbage every week. That's a routine, and it's not pleasant, for me anyhow. Brushing my teeth in a certain way, yes, that's a ritual. I'd miss it if I didn't do it a certain way. Okay, from anthropology, ritual studies, that kind of thing. Two, worship is participatory. Roman Catholics are having a dickens of a time these days trying to get their congregations to sing. They have a song leader up there a lot of times to get them to sing. I applaud that. I think that's great. But we've been singing for a long time, haven't we? And were you part of that wonderful hymn sing that Paul led a couple of nights ago at Holden Village? We did a kind of a Mennonite hymn sing with three or four wonderful hymns in four parts. Oh, beautiful. That's participation. Worship ought to be participatory. It is not a show. It is not something that these people up on the stage are presenting for these people down in an audience. Soren Kierkegaard, you know that name? Great Lutheran theologian of the last century. He has a little couple of paragraphs saying that our church architecture works against us in this. Contradicts what our gospel is. Our gospel is participatory. Our gospel means to invite everybody on stage, whereas in the typical church, you have a chancel and a nave. Up in the chancel are the performers. They're putting on a show for the people in the nave, the audience. God is in the prompter's box whispering cues to the leaders. Bad. That is not Christian worship. Christian worship is participatory. I had another thought there. Where was I going with that? Turn to your neighbor. I've been talking too much for a long time. Turn to your neighbor and talk for a second and see if I'm making any sense to you while I find my place. Okay, now I'll call you to attention again. Kierkegaard's point is that it's not that the worship leaders and the pastor and the choir are putting on a show for these people. Everybody ought to feel invited on stage, and it's God who's in the prompter's box. Pardon me, it's God who's in the audience, and it's the pastor and worship leaders who are in the prompter's box. And here's a picture of worship using that kind of a analogy. See everybody standing around the table, everybody raising hands the way the pastor does? Okay, the chief voice, in other words, is the people's voice, not the pastor's or the worship leader's voice. Inclusive, that's three. Another word for that is Catholic. A lot of Protestants, and Lutherans included, are sometimes kind of paranoid about that word Catholic because we think it means Roman Catholic, capital C. But this is small c, and small c means universal, whole, not lacking in any part. Should children be in worship every Sunday? Absolutely. It's part of the Catholic Church. I have problems when I see advertised youth service today. Every Sunday ought to be Youth Sunday and have a youth service. Now, that's a dickens of a job for a pastor to try to put together a service and much less preach to that kind of diverse crowd. But that's who said your job was supposed to be easy. I mean, the Catholic Church includes rich and poor, black and white, old and young, able-bodied and disabled, and let's face it, we're all of us only temporarily able-bodied. Gravity gets us all sooner or later. I mean, the day is soon coming when I'm not going to be able to go up those chancel steps for communion. See what they've done in this building? Taken out the chancel steps. No steps. Altar on the level of the people. Rich and poor, old and young, black and white, slave and free, male and female. How about that one? That is a difficult one these days. How about this one? Left wing politically and right wing politically. I said the other day, I consider myself politically left of Teddy Kennedy. But I have to pray my prayers as a leader of worship so that somebody right of Rush Limbaugh will be able to say amen to it. Now that is a difficult job, but that is part of my responsibility as a pastor. I want to have that whole Catholic community in front of me. And if it's not there, I should invent it. I should pretend that it's there, and maybe one day it will be. Okay, that's inclusive. Post-literate, how about that? That's also, how about the literate and the illiterate in your church? And let me tell you, you have a lot more illiterate or functionally illiterate people in your church than you think you do. People who can read a stop sign or who can read the label on the cereal box but can't read much else. And yet we insist on putting page after page of material in front of people. What does it mean when we hand them a hymn book, we hand them a bulletin, we hand them a psalm, we hand them a bulletin insert? I mean, oh my Lord, that's too much text. What are the signals we're sending? Two signals. First, this is going to be difficult, folks. And second, sorry, but you have to know how to read to be here. The aged with poor eyesight, little kids who haven't learned how to read yet, we should make worship so that it welcomes all of those people. Okay, inclusive, where are we? Sacramental and incarnational. I said that before. I'll say it again. Cataphatic. You know the word incarnation? A lot of Americans apparently know the word reincarnation, but they never heard the word incarnation.
Crazy.
Carnus. You know what the root for that? Here, I sound like my own father. You know what that root is? C-A-R-N? Same root in chili con carne. What's chili con carne?
Chicken.
Chili, beans.
With meat.
With meat, yeah.
With meat.
Carne is meat. Flesh. Carnival. Farewell to the flesh. Carnival, just before Lent. Wherever you see that C-A-R-N, that's meat or flesh. And incarnation means God coming in the flesh in the man Jesus. God coming in that bread and that cup in communion. God coming in the molecules of that water in baptism. God coming, get this, in the molecules of your neighbor. Your neighbor is Christ to you. And you are to be Christ to your neighbor. Martin Luther said that. Okay. The fullest truth about God, I think this is from, what's his name? Gordon Lathrop. The fullest truth about God is not one word, but two words. Word and sacrament. And I like that. And much of our worship is very word reductionist. That's my term for a view that says all that's important in worship is the words. You get the words down, and that's all that's important. Your homework is finished. Well, it's not finished. You should be asking yourself, what kind of space are we worshiping in? What are the gestures that are important? The telegraph, the speak. That's all part of the word, I would argue. The word takes all these forms. Human beings express and communicate in a lot of different ways. I gave the statistic earlier this week. 55% of everything you learn about me when you first meet me is non-verbal. How I stand, how I sit, how I move, whether I smile or whether I frown, all of that is non-verbal. On top of that 55%, 38% is still not verbal, but vocal. Whether I'm speaking loudly and harshly, or whether I'm speaking gently and collegially, that's all vocal. Train a puppy, you know, bad dog. The dog doesn't speak English, but he knows something's wrong. Mm-hmm. That's vocal. What's left, dear friends? 55 plus 38? 7%. 7%, dear friends, is the actual verbal content of what I'm saying. And as I said a couple days ago, that should give a pastor nightmares. And it should give a parent nightmares. And it should give a teacher nightmares. Human beings communicate. The word, I would say, capital W, word, is much bigger than just verbalizing. Okay. And we should be teaching a sacramental view, an incarnational view of life by means of this. All of life ought to have some of that character. Eucharist each Lord's Day, Holy Communion each Lord's Day. You see the movie, The Mission, Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro. It's, 10, 15 years old now, but it's a terrific movie. Jeremy Irons is a missionary, Roman Catholic missionary, who goes to wherever it was, Peru or somewhere in South America, last century. And Robert De Niro is a soldier who has to do his penance by coming along with Jeremy Irons and helping him. And when Jeremy Irons gets into the middle of the jungle, he's got a company of other monks with him, and he says Mass. he celebrates the communion. And pretty soon these natives looking on begin to ask him about that. And before too long, he's got them singing Gregorian chant. And he's got them singing their own songs, too. It's a wonderful movie. Okay, moving along. Justice and peace, that's all part of it. Then 5, enlarging the sign. This is from Luther. Luther wanted to enlarge the sign, by which he meant the sign value of, for instance, the communion or baptism. Lots of water at baptism. Not just the bread, but also the cup for the people. You know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, Roman Catholics didn't even allow the cup. And Luther says, no, let's allow the cup. So many Roman Catholic churches these days are allowing it. Baptism by immersion, a freestanding altar. What does it mean to see the pastor standing on the other side of a table the way the head of the family would at a family meal? That was the way it was done in the early church. A very familiar kind of thing. It's the family. Now, again, the present Pope has other ideas. He thinks we should all be facing east. Early churches, were all, I think even today, Roman Catholic churches should be facing the east, which is the direction of the rising sun, which is a picture of the resurrection. It's a wonderful, S-O-N as well as S-U-N. So, a church that faces east is a nice idea. But to have everybody facing east, even the priest turning his back to the people, talking to the wall there, I don't think that telegraphs what we want it to telegraph the way In the Round does. And over here, that's what they have. They've got it in the round. It's very nice. That's enlarging the sign. A return to primary experience. I'm fighting a losing battle on this one, but if it were my choice, I would tear out the PA system in every church. If a church needs a PA system, it's too big. I mean, what you've got with the PA system is a secondary interposition between the speaker and the hearer. And this, my speech never, that does not come from me, it comes from a box on the wall. And it's not exactly my speech, it sounds a little different. I think PA systems are terrible, but where I live, every little country church that seats 50 has to have a PA system. And you're no good. You'll agree?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's secondhand. It's not authentic. And I think we ought to have worship that is absolutely authentic as much as possible.
We would not be able to hear our pastor. Sometimes the sound system does not work, and you can't. There are a lot of people that can't hear it.
First of all, pastors and worship leaders and readers ought to be trained to project. But that still may not solve your problem. And I suppose a lot of churches need them still. I would still argue that the church is too big. Now, what do you do with a big church? Well, you're stuck with it. And I guess you have to put in a PA system. Well, let's talk. That's the end of my list.
One of the things in this book, it does have immersion as our preferred baptism. I mean, in the new book.
Yes, you're living in an age when baptism has been rediscovered. And you know Richard Kemmerer. Richard Kemmerer, he used to come here all the time. He has an artist colony now in Leavenworth, but he's a rare spirit, and he lectures about these matters, and he says, you know, you used to go into a Lutheran church or a Protestant church, even Roman Catholic church in a lot of cases, and you'd have to search to find where the baptismal font was, hidden off in some corner somewhere. When you find it, here it's got a great big wooden witch's hat cover on it that give, as he says, two men a hernia to remove it. And he says, when you do remove the cover, what do you find? An aluminum ashtray with a dead fly in the bottom. He says, that cannot possibly suggest the meaning of baptism. So here in our little chapel here, we have a bowl right at the door, and you can dip your fingers into it, and that's nice. And if you go to the European cathedrals, a lot of times they have the baptismal font right at the door. It's a great big thing. And you can dip your fingers in and make the sign of the cross on yourself. I never used to do that when I was a kid. I mean, my dad was a German pietist, right? But boy, I think it's meaningful.
They're not doing any change from baby baptism to adult baptism now, are they?
Well, yeah, adult baptism raises problems, but we're probably going to see more adult baptisms.
Immersion baptism?
And immersion, right, sometimes with a robe of some kind on. It's not nudity. Although nudity would certainly be the best symbol. I explained, Martin Marty has a wonderful little book about baptism where he describes a primitive Christian baptism where the men would meet with the deacon in one location and the women would meet with the deaconess, a woman deacon, in another location, and they would be dunked. First of all, they would take off all their clothes. Women let down their hair, take off their jewelry. This is a sign of everything in the old life that they were leaving behind. Wonderful picture. You step down into the water and get dunked three times, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Come up on the other side of the water and you put on a white robe. clothed in the righteousness of Christ. Nice, huh? And it's the same white robe they'll be using tomorrow in worship. The alb. The alb is essentially a baptism garment. And, may I say, the christening robe of a baby, that's a baptism garment. I mean, that's a fancied up alb for the little baby. I dunked my own grandchild, my first grandchild, in a church that had a great big font. And I dunked her. I didn't dunk her over her head, but I dunked her and sprinkled on her head, and she screamed. It was wonderful. I mean, you wrap her right away in a blanket, you know, in a towel.
Well, I'm struggling with the what I'm going to call extreme symbolism versus theology that you're talking about. And I mean, I understand how the symbolism can enhance, but saying that something must be this way in order to be theologically sound doesn't work for me. I mean, maybe I'm too far in that upper left-hand quadrant of your circle, but do you see these, are these things and elements of trying to provide a more meaningful service, or do you see these as fundamental theologically required?
I would hate to say the latter. I would hate to be so hard-nosed to say this is the way it has to be. And I don't even think that the right questions when you come to worship or liturgy or ritual or anything like that is this right or is this wrong? I think a better answer is, better question is, what is most faithful? What preaches the... preaches the word we want to preach? That's a better question. So I was baptized with just a couple of sprinkles of water on my head, and you were too probably, and it's a valid baptism. But I'm asking, would that show to an atheist or a Hindu or a Buddhist the fullness of what we're talking about? And I would say no, not as good as some of these other things.
Well, dunking. Where I wrestle with is we have divisions between the Missouri Synod and the ELCA, and we have divisions between the way Baptists do things and the way Lutherans do things and so on. And to me, many of those are just totally meaningless because a lot of them have to do with ritual. I mean, there's some real theological differences, but so many of the things that people argue over and struggle over are these outward symbolisms, and I think that sometimes saying that it must be this way or this is the most faithful way is just another way of causing more division as opposed to bringing people together. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think you've got a good point, and I hope I'm not coming across as if saying, well, this is the way it has to be. I would not want to be interpreted.
That's what I'm asking. So that means it's not so much theologically required as it is.
It's more than just nice to do, though.
I understand. Okay.
It's part of the word. I mean, that's my argument here, that human beings speak and communicate in a lot of different ways besides just verbalizing, and we should be conscious of that. And too often we're not conscious. Not enough conscious of it. So you've got a good point. I mean, I would constantly have to hear people like you to keep me honest.
Go ahead.
In the circle that you drew,
yes,
with the quadrants, where on this scale do the fundamentalists fall in? In an area where there's a huge fundamentalist church, which I do not necessarily agree with at all. But where in that scale do they go? I just finished reading Carter's book on our declining morals, and he...
Our endangered
values.
Ah.
And he puts a lot of the root of the world's problems with the fundamentalist movement, yeah. be they Christian, Muslim, whatever.
Yes.
So where in that
where would you put
think they would go?
A lot of them are unhappy or uncomfortable with all these cataphatics things, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Oh, very.
They still have some amount of form. It may not be the form that we're used to, but they still have...
Where's the voice coming from?
Oh, sorry.
Oh, here.
Yeah. They still seem to have some kind of form, like some standard flow. Does that count or not count toward being not all the way to the left?
Uh-huh. Yeah, the fundamentals, you might be able to find them all over that map. Yeah, I haven't thought of that before. I wonder where Urban Holmes puts them.
there's a sense that if you do an extreme experience of the revealed God, and you have to feel about it, it would put you clear down in the extreme corner of the cataphatic
yeah,
heart.
Yeah. Maybe
because,
so.
Because what has to happen is God is demonstrated in the world, and you have strong emotions in order to make that happen.
And a lot of the fundamentals would be very anti-intellectual, wouldn't they? Mm-hmm. Anti-brain, anti-thinking, anti-rational.
That might be one reflection.
Yeah. Thank you.
just to do a funny little plug, my workshop next session is basically on that circle that you started.
Sure. Go ahead. Your turn.
Well, it won't happen until next week, but I'm going to take those quadrants and do them more directly.
Haha! Wonderful. That'll be Monday or Tuesday.
Monday morning.
Wonderful.
So you were great. Thank you very much. It's like it was planned.
Okay.
That was A.
I guess my question is for advice on how, if you're in, I guess particularly looking at the participatory
yes.
sign there, where with Lutheran churches moving into quote unquote contemporary worship and the emergence of the praise band,
mm-hmm.
Because this is something that we're struggling with at the church that we're in, and we've been through a series of discussions about how having, you know, 6 to 10 people on mics at the front of the church does not encourage other people to sing and is discouraging a lot of people.
Three-part harmony and
yeah,
else.
I mean, and they sing three-part harmony and they put the words up on the PowerPoint screen, but what is being sung is not exactly what's on the PowerPoint screen, which makes it even harder for people to sing along. And we've been through one round of trying to talk about this, and we've basically been told that it's not a performance. We're just there to leave, and there's
this
no...
This is purely participatory. We're sitting there going...
There's no, and we're both really struggling with how to continue that conversation, how to maybe try that conversation again, but people are so emotional about it in a way that as soon as you bring it up, it's this anger and this shutdown and this, the worship and music director almost quit because we brought up some of these issues, and not in a way that said, you're a bad worship and music director,
he's
only been there a few, and he just... And he didn't want to talk about it. The pastor had to bring us all together right away so we could have this discussion. And basically, the pastor doesn't want to lose his worship and music director,
sure.
which is completely understandable. And so the conversation just kind of died. And there's this hesitancy on my part to bring it up again because I don't want to reinflame that anger. But on the other hand, it's something that's very vitally important to the two of us. We've been in a campus ministry setting where that happened, and it got to the point where people were angry about it and were very upset, and we're starting to see some of those same things happen again. So I don't know how to go in and talk about it so that people aren't upset. I don't want it to sit too long so that it just gets blown away, but I don't want to make everyone angry again. But it just, to us, it just seems so important that, you know, I mean, I have 6 years of vocal music training, and I sit in the pews, and I can't sing along sometimes because the harmonies are so thick I can't find the melody, or you know, and it's very hard for me.
A lot of the praise band stuff that I have experienced anyhow, and I have not experienced a lot of it, but I have experienced some of it, and a lot of it is very, quote-unquote, soloistic.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you have to have Madonna.
Mm-hmm.
or you have to have Britney Spears or somebody. I mean, you know, they know how to phrase and they know how to sing that stuff the way it ought to be sung. The best congregational stuff, it seems to me, is congregational. It's meant for people to sing, people, ordinary people to sing. And I've been to praise services where they have the PowerPoint projections and everything, and the band is making a lot of noise, and the people up front are making a lot of noise, but the people in the pew are hardly opening their mouth.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you a question? Paul, go ahead.
Far from being engaging you, it turns you off, or it turned me off.
Just a question to you. I agree with you 100%. We had this conversation yesterday, I think. But does it bring in people that would not otherwise be there?
See, and that's...
And I mean, I'm not saying that's the only value system, right. But does it open the door?
I think that in the church that we're in has just started this service, which is kind of why we've been working to have this conversation before. You know, you do things three times in a Lutheran church and it's tradition and it can't change. What we've seen is that some of the people who have come in are new people who are Lutheran, who are new to the DC area because it's, you know, a very transient area. And they come in because they're Lutheran and they're looking for a Lutheran church. I have not yet seen, I mean, the numbers fluctuate. It's been over the summer. I don't think it's long enough to tell at this point. I think it appeals to... That type of service, Ben's done more research into what group of people that appeals to more, and it may.
Do you have just one worship setting, or is
this is our
one,
new our new service.
Third service.
And it was also interesting. Apparently, the pastor has had some bad experiences with worship and music committees, so he doesn't believe in having them, period. So he has given sole discretion to this guy who he just hired that, you know, has worked in all kinds of, you know, very ecumenical background, which is great, but, you know, he's given sole discretion to choosing all the songs, to doing everything, to choosing how all this worship stuff is going to work to this guy he hired, which, you know, I mean, as a member of the community, I didn't have any input in, and I don't have any input from week to week, and I play the drums for the service, and I'm very seriously thinking about quitting.
Yeah, and
because of this.
When we brought up the idea that there was a need for conversation, the pastor's original response was, no.
Were you both here last week?
No, we just came in.
Oh,
yes.
Because Paul, who was our worship, our musician, he had a wonderful way, I felt, of bringing, he played guitar, and they had a little drum set and so on. It was wonderful worship, but it was also very participatory.
Yeah.
Now, this ought to be said. Any kind of music will be different or exotic to somebody.
Right.
Yeah. And I hope that the praise chorus people will also sing, "Oh God, our help in ages past." You know.
Well, yeah.
And I think there ought to be, every service, in other words, ought to be a blended service.
I agree with that.
Every service ought to have some old, some new, some German chorales, some play song, for goodness sake, some guitar thing from the Caribbean or whatever. You know, that would be the ideal type of worship for me.
But do you have any help on how to continue this conversation in our church?
Visit my website. I didn't put that on the board here, but I should again. It's not my website. It's the worship website of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. And it's the best website on worship in the whole internet. Roman Catholics don't have a better one. Presbyterians don't have a better one.
Just a word from somebody who's going through a congregation with extreme difficulties, some of which are centered on what you're talking about. You need to be talking to your church council. Because the pastor should not be the one making that decision.
Well, there's some interesting dynamics
I understand,
as well.
But that's where it's got to go.
Yeah.
And so it's like what I was looking at is I did some research, and it looked, you know, what we have is what's quite probably the best service statistically for the baby boomer generation. But they said when we were planning the service that they were really trying to reach out to my age group, which is predominantly the population just north of us. So
I would say, if you want to hear my opinion, yeah. even that is a mistake.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
I mean, we ought to be, every service right. ought to be the whole Catholic Church.
Right. They were, I think there was a push to, where you're talking about bringing in people who don't have a strong church background, and in the area where we're in, that's the highest population. I'm also not entirely sure that people who are not familiar, not growing up in a church background, would pick the Lutheran church, unless you had a contemporary service that moved away from liturgy, because I think if that's not what you grew up being used to, it's very hard to move into that and feel comfortable with it, as you said.
I should say, I write an essay every month for this website. Look for my name.
Okay.
CA stands for Canada, yeah, worship.ca. Yeah. And I've written 107 of them, 10 years worth.
Oh, wow.
Every month I write a new one. We got to quit, friends. Thank you very much.
Thank you.